WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump will meet for the first time tonight on the presidential debate stage. So what will each candidate have to prove to win over voters, especially independents and people who haven't made up their minds? To break it down, we're joined by Jason DeSanto, a senior lecturer in the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law and a Democratic debate strategist. Before diving into strategy, I wanted to get his thoughts on the rules that both candidates will have 2 minutes to answer each question and 2 minutes to respond to their opponent. Also, that their mics will be muted while the other is speaking. Here's Jason.
Well, they're pretty basic rules that were in effect for debate number one between Biden and between Trump. There's been a lot of talk about the mics being muted and which way that cuts. Some talk about maybe Harris wanted the mics to be on because she thought she could bait Trump. I think ultimately what this comes down to is you can do a lot without the mics being on, mm-hmm. if your goal, and maybe one of Harris's goals, is to bait Trump or be able to quote unquote interrogate Trump.
Yeah, the actual quote from the Harris campaign, they say they'll be quote fundamentally disadvantaged if the mics aren't live the whole time. I mean, what do you think of that choice? I mean, will it help or hurt either candidate?
I think that's working the refs. I think that's really what it is. When Trump says that ABC is nasty and is basically unfair, he is trying to set people's understandings and expectations of what's going to happen. When we talk about the fact that mics might be muted or not muted, and here the Harris campaign is saying that this fundamentally disadvantages her, I think that is also working how audiences may receive the messaging. Mm. On balance, there is plenty that a debater can do without having to rely on a mic being live for their opponent. And if those are the goals that she has, to be able to assert who she is, introduce herself, but also diminish Trump or even bait Trump, she can do that without his mic being live.
Well, all eyes are on Harris, to your point. This is after President Biden's fumbling performance against Trump back in June. So if you had Harris's ear, Jason, what advice would you give her?
2 words I would think about: drive and diminish. And drive means you want to control the debate, and in particular, you want to control 2 things. The way that you are projecting core leadership attributes, the kinds of things that build trust very quickly with audiences, particularly who don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. What are those things? Strength and warmth, or as I often say, authority and humanity. So you want in your answers to be very crisp, and you also want to be forging a connection with the American people frequently by looking into that camera and talking to them about their situation and their plight.
How does that look to us? If she's controlling the debate, as you mentioned, what does that look like?
She's not getting distracted by him. And that's a way in which maybe the mics being off are actually helpful to her, is she can continue to try to forge that connection with people. So, for example, if there's a question about the economy, mm-hmm. it is important to speak to people where they are. So if people feel like prices are higher than they were a few years ago, it's important to acknowledge that, not by looking at your opponent or looking at the moderator, but looking directly to people at home, and then talk a little bit about why you're going to fight for them and your opponent will not. And to do that while forging the connection with people just by looking directly at them. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at the debate that she had with Mike Pence in 2020, she was quite effective in doing that when it came time for her to make what were the strongest arguments I think that Biden-Harris wanted to make that year about COVID.
Right.
When she looked directly into the camera and talked about the fact that, in her view, the Trump administration had been dishonest and had downplayed the threat in a way that was not conducive to solving the problem. Those were delivered right to camera. That was effective. And there's still room to refer to your opponent and look at your opponent. Mm. The diminishing part is not to get caught up with him and to be able to continue keeping your eye on the camera as much as you can and the people at home and thinking about the fact that 28% of the people out there, according to the most recent polling, don't feel they know enough about you.
Right.
And we can talk more about how that's always a problem for vice presidents who are running and some things she can
when
do
when people don't know you. Yeah. Now, here's something that her campaign has really leaned into, and that's her experience as California's attorney general. Since Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts, right? So do you think that this "I'm a prosecutor going up against a convicted felon" narrative is working for her?
I think it works on one axis that is important, and that is a projection of strength, a projection of common sense, a projection of not being more or too liberal and more mainstream. If you put any faith in the most recent polling from the New York Times this weekend, there were 47% of those who were polled who believe that she's too liberal. Now, why do they believe that? Well, they believe that because they don't know a lot about her. But one of the antidotes to that is a career as a prosecutor putting away criminals. And in particular, because she's going to be facing a candidate who's going to be relentless on issues involving crime and to try to paint her as being out of the mainstream. When people don't know who you are and they don't trust who you are, one of the easiest tacks for any Republican candidate to use since time immemorial is to say that you were weak on crime, to say that you lack common sense. And to some extent, those claims and claims about the border don't just work on that issue. They work on the larger value-based access of common sense.
Yeah.
Does this person have common sense? So the prosecutor argument is an antidote to that. It not only frames Trump as a criminal and reminds people of his criminal record.
Right.
It reminds people of her experience in a position of strength and in a position of good judgment.
Now, Harris has been preparing through mock debates. This is with a former aide to Hillary Clinton. Is that enough, you think, to help her respond to Trump's claims, especially if they're belittling or false?
So in preparing people for debates, I think the value of mock debates is it makes the candidate more agile, but more agile so they can be the best version of themselves. I believe when you put a candidate through the mock debate, you're preparing them for terrible eventualities, sometimes and hopefully worse than what they're going to face on stage. And that when you do that, when things happen in a debate that are not predicted, and they do happen, no matter how much you practice, the person has the confidence, reserve, and resolve to be able to just handle themselves. So the short answer to your question is, yes, it will prepare her. Will it be enough? I don't think we know that until we actually see it.
We shall see.
But I think it beats the alternative of not preparing.
Oh, for sure. Let's turn now to Donald Trump. So we've seen him take the presidential debate stage plenty of times by now, Jason. He doesn't show restraint. He makes these indirect or grandiose, often false statements. Does this debating style still seem to be working for Trump?
It works for him when he does show restraint. So I'm going to push back just a little bit on the question of whether he shows restraint. In the debate in June against Joe Biden, he was judged to have done better than Biden because the bar being measured against how Biden did was pretty low. There were a lot of people who said, well, if you really looked at Trump's performance, he lied a lot. He was rambling a lot. All of that is true. But he was reserved compared to his usual demeanor. And that's really the prism and the lens through which people who are persuadable would view this. Does this person seem less bombastic, grandiose, and over the top than usual? So when he displays that, I think he's relatively effective. In 2020, against Joe Biden in the first debate, he did not. And that was when, in debate number one, he was over the top. When Biden said, "Will you shut up, man," in order to get him to stop talking, then it doesn't work for him. If you go back to 2016 in his debates against Hillary Clinton, I went back and looked at some of them in thinking about coming on today.
Yeah.
And what you're struck by is how effective Hillary Clinton is in the blocking and tackling of debate. She didn't get ruffled. She has great command of the facts. She handles issues well. And to some extent, she handled him well. But what I was struck by was how relentless he was and how he still controlled that debate.
Right.
Even though on the individual skirmishes, Clinton did fine, he controlled the debate because he stayed laser focused on one or two big picture
items. Just kept repeating
items.
Them.
When he does that, he's effective. So tonight, border, crime, too liberal, Biden economy. Those are the things that he would need to stick to.
So his number one objective, though, out of that list tonight?
His number one objective is to hammer the economy. Number two is the border. Number three is a combination of those two things, indicating to people that Harris is not ready for the job, is out of touch, and is too far to the left.
Now, several high-profile Republicans have come out saying that they're voting for Harris. What does Trump have to do to get support from his own party? And I wonder if there is a chance, Jason, of him winning back the Republicans for Harris.
That won't happen. What will happen is he will cast a wide net and say that these are all part of the problem in Washington. The Dick Cheneys of the world, the Adam Kinzingers, they might as well be Democrats because what they represent is an old way of thinking. And he probably will tie them together in the idea of Iraq, the neocons, a traditional way of thinking about foreign policy. And to those who support him, they will find that to be persuasive. To Republicans who are on the fence, they might think in retrospect that Iraq was a mistake. And so to the extent he can define the Kinzingers and the Cheneys of the world as being part of that foreign policy viewpoint, he may be able to pick up a few votes. Mm-hmm. But he's not going to pick up the people who are already avowed Republicans against Trump. That's just not going to happen at this point.
The reality is, though, that Harris and Trump, they're neck and neck in the latest polls. What do you think will be the deciding factor this election?
Harris building trust with people will be the deciding factor.
You mentioned earlier her getting us getting to know her.
So let's talk about that for a little bit. Vice presidents, generally when they run and are coming out of the shadow of somebody who was the president before, always have that question of defining who they are compared to the person before, whether the person was popular or not. That was the case as far back as Richard Nixon breaking from Dwight D. Eisenhower. Certainly was true for Al Gore trying to put aside some of the bad memories of Clinton's personal behavior. And it was the question for George H.W. Bush coming out of 8 years of Reagan. Which parts of the Reagan tradition could he meaningfully embrace? Particularly because people remembered or were reminded that he had run against Reagan in the 1980 primaries and had called Reagan's economics voodoo economics. So now you have Kamala Harris. She also has taken some positions which were similar to Joe Biden's, but also different from Joe Biden's. She's perhaps backed away from some of those positions as well. She has to build that trust in a much more accelerated time frame than your normal vice president trying to build that trust. Now, the good news is we live in a media environment now, whereas receivers of information, I think we're prepared to make judgments much more quickly. My advice to her would be don't let policy and the focus on whether or not people know your policies override your focus in the debate on values. Don't let the idea that people don't think they know your policies drive you to give a primer on policy. Do talk about what your policies will be. But when you walk into the debate, in that debate, right at the top of the sheet, middle class, patriotism, unity, family. And use those as the guidepost for how you're going to talk about your policies, including on the economy. I'll fight for the middle class. Donald Trump is giving tax cuts to the rich. So now people will begin to hear what your policies are, but they're going to hear them in a way that will be easier for them to digest emotionally. Because my view is when people say they don't know enough about your policy, they don't mean the minute details of every policy. They mean enough to know whether your policies may help them and whether when they're not looking, which is most of the time for us in this country, they trust your judgment.
It's like, I don't know if I trust you yet. That's what that translates to.
If I'm not there, can I trust your ability to make decisions
right.
the way I would?
Yeah.
And that's really what people need to pick up quickly.
No, it isn't just the candidates who we're relying on for the debate to go smoothly, Jason. What will the moderators have to do to just ensure that the night's successful and respectful?
Well, there's where the mics being muted probably help. They help the job of the moderator. We've had this question for a long time about whether moderators should be fact-checking. But we've never had a candidate like Donald Trump. You remember in the movie Jaws, where Richard Dreyfuss's character is explaining to the mayor that the shark is a perfect eating machine. That's what he was bred to do. That's his nature. Trump is a perfect lie machine. From the minute he gets on stage at the debate, he's going to be exaggerating. He's going to be taking advantage and saying things that often are not true or only partially true. And so the problem for a moderator has always been whether or not they should be fact-checking. The problem with moderating Trump is how much?
Yeah.
How often? So a little probably goes a long way.
Yeah.
Enough to check at least some of it and enough to make sure that the two are engaging with the questions as asked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's a successful evening.
Well, I don't envy the moderator. I'll just say that.
I don't either.
We've been talking with Jason DeSanto, who is a Democratic debate strategist and senior lecturer in the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. Thank you so much for that breakdown.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Ellie Gilbert Baer. It was mixed by Ari Mejia and edited by Dan Tucker. Reset pairs nuance and breaking news. Now, if this sounds like what you're looking for, make sure to check out our full archive of conversations at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you later.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.